Welcome to a deep dive into the microscopic battleground of material science. Today, we are taking the ultimate shortcut to being well-informed, diving headfirst into a single, dense 1975 PhD dissertation. Okay, let's unpack this. Our source material isn't a quick journal article. It's a deep academic dive focused on figuring out exactly what happens atom by atom when you blast a metal surface with an impossibly high electric field.
And that mission was, you know, incredibly important at the time. The topic is the rigorous development and application of new experimental techniques in a specialized field called field ion microscopy, or HEM, and its cousin, field desorption microscopy.
Right.
The overall scientific goal was really just clarifying the fundamental physical processes of how those ion images form and how atoms actually evaporate from the surface. In 1975, these core mechanisms were, as the author put it, not well understood.
FIM is absolutely brilliant, though. It was invented in 1951 and it uses a needle. And, I mean, you have to imagine a metal tip so sharp, maybe 10 to 200 nanometers across, that you can almost treat it like a single atom point. When you hit that tip with a huge positive potential, say 1 to 30 kilovolts, you generate an electric field that is truly staggering, up to 600 million volts per centimeter.
Yeah.
This field ionizes gas atoms floating nearby, and those ions fly out and create a magnified image of the atomic arrangement on the tip itself.
It's an incredible technique for, you know, visualizing the atomic world, but the underlying theory, especially for field evaporation, the process of ripping atoms directly off the surface, was fundamentally broken.
Wait, if the theory was broken, why was it still being used? What was the accepted model?
Well, the standard model was called the image force theory. It was simple, mathematically neat, and, you know, conceptually easy to grasp, but reality just refused to cooperate.
Okay.
When they tried to match the theory to actual experimental observations, the predictions were just wildly inaccurate. And here's where it gets really interesting. The theory predicted that the rate at which atoms evaporated would change approximately 10 billion times more rapidly with just a 1% variation in the applied electric field than what they actually measured in the lab.
10 billion times off. That's not a rounding error. That is a fundamental misunderstanding of the physics.
Exactly.
So you have a theory that's trying to explain reality, and it's missing the mark by more than an order of magnitude. What else was the image force theory failing to explain?
Oh, it failed on several crucial points. It couldn't correctly predict the charge species, the specific ion state expected to evaporate from the surface.
Okay.
It completely ignored short-range interatomic potentials, which are critical when atoms are only nanometers apart. And it failed to account for how deeply the electric field actually penetrates the metal surface.
So all the microscopic details that really govern what's happening.
All the important details, yeah.
So the physics community was stuck. They knew the model was wrong, but the theoretical fixes were just as problematic.
Exactly. There was a conceptually superior alternative, the charge exchange model, which tried to include these missing details, the field penetration depth, those specific interatomic potentials. But in 1975, they involved too many unknown or, you know, poorly understood quantities.
So you couldn't calculate them?
You couldn't measure them, and they were too complex to calculate reliably. The clear conclusion was that the scientific path was blocked. Theory was dealing simultaneously with too many uncalculatable parameters. If the math was stuck, the only way forward was to build a machine capable of forcing reality to give up its secrets.
Which brings us to the real pivot of this dissertation, the experimental innovation. The solution wasn't better math, it was better tools. To bridge that enormous gap, the work involved developing a completely custom-built electrostatic dispersive spectrometer for energy analysis. They literally had to design and build a new, incredibly precise eye for the microscope to measure the energy of those tiny evaporated ions.
And this was a monumental engineering feat. They chose a specific design, a 90-degree electrostatic deflection type analyzer. You can think of it like a prism for ions. Instead of separating light colors based on wavelength, it separates ions based on their kinetic energy by bending their path as they travel through the instrument.
And the angle tells you the energy.
The angle of their deflection tells you exactly how much energy they possess.
And the precision required here is just mind-boggling. You're measuring the energy of single atoms, which have just traveled a distance equivalent to a human hair, having been zapped off the surface.
Precisely. To capture that data single ions hitting the detector, they needed a high-gain microchannel plate detector. And crucially, the system was designed for an exceptionally high energy resolution, approximately 1 volt of resolution across the necessary energy range.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, if the tip voltage was 5.6 kilovolts, they could distinguish an ion with 5,600 volts of energy from one with 5,601 volts.
That is surgical precision. And if you are trying to measure energy spectra down to that single volt resolution, every tiny flicker in the high voltage power supply will just ruin your data. You need stability you can set your watch to decades in advance.
That was a huge headache. The high voltage supply had to maintain stability better than 40 parts per million over a 15-minute interval. To achieve this, they had to modify the power supply itself. They reduced the conventional current limiting resistor, which was usually 1 gigohm, all the way down to a mere 25 megohms.
So, if you're not an electrical engineer, why does that resistance change matter?
It's a trade-off. By lowering that resistance, they were accepting more noise in the system, but they gained far superior current stability when the tip inevitably sparked or discharged. This was the key functional change that allowed the measuring system to remain steady enough to capture the energy spectrum accurately, rather than just reading voltage fluctuations. It stabilized the system against the very phenomenon they were trying to study.
That's a wonderful example of science having to build a new road just to take the first step. Once they had their new stable eye, they could start looking for the unknown. And one of the first surprising things they found wasn't even a metal atom, but the imaging gas itself.
Right. They investigated the role of the inert imaging gas, like helium. This had been a mystery. The results confirmed that inert gases like helium and neon are field adsorbed onto the metal surface for considerable lengths of time, even at temperatures as warm as 78 Kelvin, or liquid nitrogen temperature.
So it's not just bouncing off.
No, it showed that the image-forming gas wasn't just bouncing off, it was forming a surprisingly stable film on the atomic surface.
And this film led to the discovery of the Jason Peaks. And here's where we get those true aha moments. Mm-hmm. When they used gas mixtures, say helium and hydrogen, they consistently measured helium or neon ions that had unexpectedly high energies. They were higher than they should have been based on where they were supposed to ionize.
Right, and if an ion has unusually high kinetic energy, it means it must have been accelerated from a starting point much closer to the specimen tip than the normal critical ionization distance. This phenomenon provided strong evidence that the high energy signal originated from the presence of field-adsorbed helium. It strongly suggested that this adsorbed layer, the stable film, promotes and enhances the normal helium ion current.
Which means the layer is actively participating in the imaging process, not just being passively ionized above the surface.
Precisely, and the calculation was fascinating. They showed that the binding energy required for a metal helium complex ion to survive the tiny 10 microsecond flight time to the detector was at least 0.1 electron volts.
And that's significant.
It's chemically significant. It's actually comparable to the accepted thermal barrier for evaporation. It proves they were dealing with a stable, chemically bonded entity, not just a passing gas atom.
That's a huge piece of the puzzle solved. Understanding how the imaging gas behaves is one thing, but the real prize for metallurgists is understanding the path of the metal atom itself. So let's shift focus now to the metal ions, because they used field desorption microscopy, FDM, and their new analyzer to tackle a critical, practical problem in the advanced instruments of the future, the atom probe, aiming errors.
This is a fundamental challenge for any kind of atomic analysis. If you are trying to analyze one specific atom on the surface, you need to be absolutely certain that the ion you detect in your machine actually originated from that one site.
Mm-hmm.
Aiming error is the divergence in trajectories between the simple imaging gas ions and the more complex evaporated metal ions.
This must be vital because if your aim is off, you're analyzing the wrong atom and your entire chemical composition analysis is just garbage.
It is absolutely vital for material science. By comparing the diameter of the helium image rings with the rings formed by evaporating tungsten ions from the plane, they quantified the size of this error. They found an aiming error of up to 25% of the lattice plane diameter.
25% sounds manageable until you translate that into the atomic scale. What does a 25% error actually look like on the tip?
Well, in the atomic context, that 25% error meant the ions were shifted by about 6 angstroms, or 0.6 nanometers, toward the center of the plane.
So that's what, 2 atoms wide?
To visualize that, 6 angstroms is roughly the width of 2 whole tungsten atoms. So if your atom probe is sampling a 20 angstrom wide area and your analyzed ion has been shifted by 2 atomic widths, you have completely missed your target atom.
That is catastrophic for analysis. And what explains a shift that large? It sounds like some powerful force is pushing the ion trajectory.
It is. That deflection requires a substantial change in tangential kinetic energy, at least 1.5 electron volts. That is far too much energy to be explained by simple thermal mechanics, like the heat of the tip. It points toward a complex electronic or field effect influencing the ion's path after it has already left the surface. Perhaps due to local field irregularities or electronic structure effects near the surface steps. This was a clear sign that the physical process was more complex than anyone had modeled.
As they solved this aiming problem, they accidentally stumbled upon the most visually stunning results of the entire study. The discovery of what the paper called unexpectedly finely detailed spatial distribution of metal ions in the FDM images. These weren't fuzzy blobs, they were intricate atomic portraits of evaporation.
The level of detail was unbelievable, and it was highly dependent on the type of metal they studied. For body-centered cubic metals, like tungsten and molybdenum, the evaporation images showed prominent ring structures around the crystallographic planes.
Right.
The centers of the major planes, like the planes, were dark and bright rays extended outward, radiating toward adjacent planes.
So the visual pattern itself told them something fundamental about how the atoms were leaving the structure. It's like the crystal structure was leaving a ghost image of itself on the detector screen.
Exactly. These structures weren't just due to changes in the specimen's shape. They reflected deep, intrinsic structural characteristics of the evaporation process. But when they moved to face-centered cubic metals, like iridium and rhodium, the patterns changed completely.
Oh, interesting.
These images showed bright lines connecting the planes, surrounded by broad dark lines, exhibiting a sort of pseudo-hexagonal symmetry.
Two different classes of metal, two fundamentally different patterns of evaporation. It's a direct visual challenge to the idea that there's one universal model for field evaporation.
And then there was aluminium, the true anomaly. Aluminium is a non-refractory, non-transition metal, and its desorption image stood completely apart. While the others showed wings, rays, or bright lines, aluminium contained no bright lines at all. None. Instead, its portrait featured an intricate network of dark zone lines. This difference suggests a fundamental variance in the way aluminium surface atoms evaporate compared to the high melting point transition metals, proving that evaporation is governed by electronic structure in ways the old theories couldn't possibly account for.
So, what does this foundational science mean for someone who is actually building a turbine blade or a microchip? What's the practical application for metallurgists and engineers using the atom probe today?
This work established that what happens at the atomic level profoundly affects your final data. For example, when they analyzed grain boundaries, the junctions where crystals meet in materials like tungsten and iridium, they saw that the boundary itself significantly deflected the trajectories of surrounding matrix ions.
I see.
The boundary appeared as a dark or bright line in the desorption image, meaning you can't trust the chemical analysis right next to a major structural defect unless you account for that bending.
That is a critical constraint. If you're looking for impurities that aggregate at a boundary, this aiming error could make them seem like they are missing or present in the wrong place.
And this led to one of the most critical operational findings. They studied a cobalt 5% tantalum alloy, which contained cotite precipitates. They found that the apparent composition of the precipitate, the chemical reading they got, was severely affected by the cleanliness of the vacuum.
How so?
Specifically, cobalt was selectively removed from the precipitants by the action of hydrogen if the specimen was not rigorously outgassed in ultra-high vacuum, or UHV.
Wait, a small amount of residual hydrogen gas in the chamber was chemically stripping atoms off the sample during the analysis, completely changing the measured chemistry?
That's exactly right. The hydrogen was interfering with the evaporation process itself, complexing with and carrying away the cobalt atoms. This confirmed a critical boundary condition. Accurate conventional atom probe analysis demands UHV conditions, or you are literally analyzing a chemically altered sample and getting the wrong answer.
This is why fundamental research into instrumentation and process physics is so crucial. The experimental evidence derived from energy analysis and desorption microscopy conclusively demonstrates the inadequacy of every field evaporation theory available in 1975. Particularly regarding ion trajectories and those complex evaporation patterns. It provided a clear mandate. Future progress absolutely relies on building more accurate instrumentation to pin down these effects.
Indeed. This work successfully established energy analysis as a viable, stable tool in FIM, calculated the aiming errors crucial for atom probe precision, and documented incredibly complex, detailed desorption images across multiple metal types. It was the necessary groundwork.
And it set the stage for the next generation of instruments. The analysis suggested that future energy analyzers needed resolutions of 0.1 volts or less over a 33-volt range to truly resolve the detailed energy spectra of evaporated metal ions. That was the technical frontier established by this work, and instrumentation has been chasing that ultra-high resolution ever since.
But perhaps the most enduring takeaway is what this work hinted at for the future of material science. It suggested that it should be possible to use this field desorption technique to chemically analyze materials that had traditionally been impossible to study.
Like what?
Things like magnesium alloys, which are soft and chemically reactive, or even glasses materials that are typically destroyed or severely affected by the high electric field necessary for conventional FIM imaging.
Because if you analyze the material based on a quick desorption pulse, you don't need that constant high field to maintain an image. That truly opens up the applicability of these techniques to a vastly wider range of metallurgical and material problems than ever before. This raises an important question. If we can circumvent the need for constant high fields for imaging, what limitations are left in material science analysis?